Events this week mark a pair of grim anniversaries 3 days apart. August 6th and 9th of 1945 are the dates of the atomic bombings by the United States of the Japanese cities of Hiroshima and Nagasaki. We know much about Hiroshima. That distinctive picture of the burned-out dome is one of those images just about everyone over a certain age knows. Nagasaki is the second city in this discussion and often gets obscured. It is lifted from obscurity in a new book by Susan Southard called Nagasaki, Life After Nuclear War. Susan Southard lives in Tempe, Arizona. She's the founder and director of a theater company, Essential Theater, artistic director, I should say. She holds an MFA in writing from Antioch University, Los Angeles, and was a nonfiction fellow at the Norman Mailer Center on Cape Cod. Susan Southard, thanks for joining us on the Jefferson Exchange today.
Thank you, Jeffrey. Glad to be here.
So you do speak Japanese and did live there for a time. Tell us about your time in Japan in your teens.
Yes, I do speak Japanese, though less well than I used to. I was in Japan for 13 months in high school as an exchange student, living with a Japanese family and going to a Japanese girls' school. And in fact, my first time in Nagasaki was that year. I was a junior in high school, but I was invited because I was the only American in the school to go with the senior class to on their week-long field trip to southern Japan. And as we circled the southernmost island of Kyushu, We made a stop in Nagasaki and went in together to the Nagasaki Atomic Bomb Museum. It was quite a profound experience in my early life.
What registered the most on you? For one thing, it sounds like this is not a lot of stuff that we know a lot about from Nagasaki, certainly.
Yes. Do you mean at that time when I was 16?
Yes.
Or,
mm-hmm.
Well, at that time, because I moved around a lot growing up, I actually hadn't yet had American history. Every school I went to had just done it the year before I went. So I had not learned about Hiroshima and Nagasaki except for knowing their names. And so standing there arm in arm with my Japanese school friends, looking into the glass cases and seeing the photographs and the artifacts and the grim things, like there was a helmet with the charred flesh of someone's scalp still attached, you know, things like that. It was really horrifying for me and made a big impact on me as it relates to not only the atomic bombings, but, of course, war itself.
And, Susan, what led to your wanting to know more later in life?
Well, a number of years later, I had the opportunity to be a translator for one of the survivors. Very unexpectedly, he was on a speaking tour in Washington, D.C. He had been 16 at the time of the bomb, and now he was 57. And I went to hear him speak, and his interpreter became unavailable, and I was invited to be his interpreter for the final 2 days of his time in Washington. And it was amazing. I did the simple task of reading his English translations of his presentations as he spoke in Japanese. But in between, I had many, many hours of personal time with him where I could talk with him more intimately about his experiences. And he told me many things that he doesn't say in public. And I was absolutely gripped by his story. And although it was a number of years later when I eventually started the book, I could never take his story and my sense of urgency about having these stories told out of my mind.
And this was Taniguchi Sumiteru?
That's right, yes.
And he is one of the hibakusha. What does that mean?
Hibakusha is the Japanese word given. It was a new word made, given to those in both Hiroshima and Nagasaki who died and survived the atomic bombings. It's a special word compared to, say, victim, or, you know, like a victim of the conventional bombings, because it infers the radiation exposure that all the survivors were exposed to.
And so we know how you got to know Taniguchi, but how did you meet the other ones that you profile in the book?
Yes, well, in 2003, when I made the decision to write the book, I went back to Nagasaki and met with Mr. Taniguchi, and there's a wonderful organization there. There are many organizations that support the word of the survivors getting out to the world, and one of them is associated with a speaking bureau for a small number of survivors, and they were very kind in introducing me to a number of survivors. And over the next few years, I went to Nagasaki five times to do follow-up interviews, and I was able to, I chose the ones whose stories I felt represented the most diverse kinds of experiences on the day of the bomb and in the decades after, because, you know, each, although there's an overarching story of living beneath the atomic cloud on that day and the lifelong survival of nuclear war, they really are very unique and individual stories, and I wanted to make sure that I could represent various aspects of this very complex story.
And among other things, we learn a lot about what daily life was like in Nagasaki. It might be a bit different from what people would expect. We'll get into that in just a few moments. Susan Southard is our guest on the Jefferson Exchange. Her book is Nagasaki, Life After Nuclear War. She profiles five people in large print about, that's the major focus of the book. We'll come back and talk more with Susan and take phone calls and emails if you'd like to join us with your thoughts about Nagasaki and the aftermath. Back on the Jefferson Exchange with Susan Southard and you in a minute 20. Back on the Jefferson Exchange on the News and Information Service of Jefferson Public Radio. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. Our guest today is the writer Susan Southard. She is observing the 70th anniversary of the bombing of Nagasaki, Japan, with the release of her book, Nagasaki, Life After Nuclear War, with major profiles of five people who lived through that bomb blast nearly exactly 70 years ago. You can join us on the Jefferson Exchange as we talk about Nagasaki and the legacy on both sides of the Pacific. 800-838-3760 by phone anywhere in the region, by email jx@jeffnet.org. How much, if at all, do the hibakusha, the people who are bomb affected, talk about their experiences within Japan anyway, Susan?
Yes, very rarely from what I understand. In Nagasaki, most survivors don't speak about their experiences, even within their families. It's an unimaginable trauma that they went through. Really, I don't use that word lightly. It really is unimaginable what happened on the day of the bomb and in the months that went on. And I think it's similar here. Often, Our war veterans don't speak about their experiences very much either. The five survivors in my book, whose stories I tell in my book, are a part of a very small cadre of survivors in Nagasaki who, for various personal reasons, made the decision to begin to speak publicly. Most of them, their unified mission is to have their stories be a part of the effort to eliminate nuclear weapons across the globe.
Let's talk about Nagasaki itself. Its history is a bit different from the rest of Japan. It's a bit more Western focused. Tell us about that.
Yes, it's a really fascinating history. It was a very small fishing and farming village in the 1500s. When Portuguese ships first arrived, finding this beautiful port city at the head of a long, narrow bay with mountains surrounding it, very close to the Asian continent, and so very accessible for European and Asian ships to come in and start trading. So Nagasaki became Japan's first international port, and because of that, became kind of a vanguard for Japan's early modernization. And then, as Christianity, it also was the earliest city for Christian and Catholic outreach. And as the leaders of the Japanese, it wasn't really a united as united a nation as it is now, but as leaders across the country felt threatened by the Christian influence, they closed Japan's borders for 200 years, and Nagasaki alone was allowed to do limited trade. So they still had access to some European countries' ships coming in and some Asian countries' ships coming in all the way through when the rest of Japan had no access to anything from outside their borders.
So Nagasaki really functioned as Japan's window to the West, its only window to the West, or porthole, I guess you could think
of it. Yes, it was very rich, very rich. And then when Japan reopened its relationships and reestablished its relationships with the West, Nagasaki continued to thrive and became the world's third largest shipbuilding city, and the Catholics who had practiced their religion in secret for all those years were able to reemerge, and it became the home of the largest Catholic church in East Asia too. It had a very beautiful and unique history.
Susan Southard is our guest on the Jefferson Exchange. Her book is Nagasaki, Life After Nuclear War. Let's talk about the city a little more. Obviously, it had a view to the West, but Japan, as it got more militaristic, did Nagasaki get swept up in that, too? Was there a very dim view of Western powers?
Yes. I mean, the whole country by that time was a united country, and when the militarists really took hold in Japan, the influence was total, and the level of control top down went into every neighborhood and every household in Japan, and no opposition was allowed, and no news outside of what the government fed the Japanese civilians across the country was ever heard. So they only knew what the Japanese were feeding them, which was really, as biased and as kind of militaristic as possible, really.
Always cast them in the best light.
Yes, and their enemies in the worst light.
Ah, that's the more important part, I guess. Yeah. The book proceeds forward in time through 9 chapters. What shape was Nagasaki in compared to other Japanese cities by the summer of 1945?
Well, like other Japanese cities, starvation was rampant. Food rationing, because Japan put all of its money and supplies and resources and people into the war effort. Almost every man was somewhere was in the military. Rationing by the summer of 1945 was extreme. You know, 2 cups of rice per person per month, and they were eating weeds and insects and making boiled down rice grains and pumpkin seeds to try to eat. And every child over 14 was mandated to work for the war effort. They had to leave school. The difference is that in Nagasaki, the city had been attacked several times with small conventional bombing attacks, and there were people killed and buildings destroyed. But Nagasaki, as one of the final target cities for the atomic bombings, was not razed to the ground with incendiary bombs as 64 other cities already had been in across Japan, and they were unsure why they had been spared and were speculating about that without any true understanding. And also, it's really interesting. I mean, it's horrific, but it was. Nagasaki being on the island of Kyushu, which was the military government knew was a likely landing spot for the invasion of Allied troops. Nagasaki was in very high-level preparation without almost any real, they didn't have any military bases there, but they were preparing for the enemy to arrive.
That would be the beachhead, the Normandy, in a sense, in the Pacific, if it had come to a land invasion.
I'm not sure if Nagasaki. They thought Nagasaki itself would be the exact location, but the island was the closest to you know, was the furthest west and the closest to Asia and the closest closest entry point for Allied troops. So they knew that somewhere on that island, and so Nagasaki was an obvious potential target.
Let's talk about some of the people you profile in the book. We mentioned that there were five primary ones, all in their teens at the time. Wada Koichi was 18 years old. He had a fairly rough life even before the war. What had happened in his family?
Yes, and it's true for many of the survivors. He lost his mother, I think he was 11, and when she gave birth to his younger sister. And he lost his father to tuberculosis 2 years later. So he and his sister were being raised by his grandparents, and he had wonderful memories of his father. And Nagasaki's baseball team having a major Russian player who was the fastest pitcher in Japan, and he was wonderful to talk to because he had such strong memories of pre-war Nagasaki. And he was required to work for the war effort. He didn't get to finish school, and his job was one of the most non-military type jobs. He was a streetcar driver at an early age, and was driving. Well, he wasn't actually driving a streetcar. He had just gotten back to the terminal at the moment the bomb was dropped.
And it turns out there was a bit of a lucky derailment that day on the
yes.
streetcar line in Nagasaki.
Well, lucky for him.
Lucky for him, yes. Yeah.
Yeah. There was a streetcar derailment in the hour or so prior to the bombing, and he, because of that, he had to take an alternate route back to the terminal and wasn't driving through. He would have been moving through what became the hypocenter area of the bombing. Had that derailing not happened.
What were Wada's feelings about the war? I was a little surprised to find out that there was not uniformity in opinion about the war in Japan.
Yes, well, it's interesting because he wasn't ever able to speak about it, of course, but as a young child, Nagasaki was such an international city that he had friends from many other countries, from Russia and France and the United States and I believe England, maybe Dutch, and he got to go over to their houses, he ate their food, and he loved it. And he was so interested in that part of his life. They were just really nice friends. And as the war began, those friends were expelled, those families were expelled from Japan, and he thought that was, and they were then posited by the military government as enemies, and it didn't make sense to him, and he didn't like that he wasn't able to go to school, and he had these doubts that what he was hearing was true. He was a little bit older than the others in the story, and he actually really remarkably showed a kind of a silent resistance, a secret resistance, by lying on his draft during the physical examination for his draft, basically faked that he couldn't see. That, you know, he already wore glasses, but he could see better than he said, and he was excused because of his alleged vision limitations.
Wow, he flunked his eye exam on purpose.
Yes, and if anyone had ever known, he would have been imprisoned for that. Mm-hmm. So it was quite remarkable that he did that, and he ultimately was one of the people who worked tirelessly in the relief and rescue efforts after the bombing. So, you know, the city was lucky to have him.
Wada Koichi, one of five people profiled, primary profiles in Susan Southard's book, Nagasaki, Life After Nuclear War, the 70th anniversary of the Nagasaki bombing on Sunday. You can join us on the Jefferson Exchange as we talk to Susan. Susan, 800-838-3760 by phone, 800-838-3760 if you're over 45, 3760 if you're under, and by email, jx@jeffnet.org. Wolfgang in Sunny Valley, welcome to the Jefferson Exchange.
Hey, good morning. sunny morning, actually, right now. What strikes me about the subject is the stark contrast between the very personal stories of these people, and I know other personal stories of other locales in different times, you know, from First World War up to some present-day Iraq and whatever. So the actual personal experience on the one hand, and the total disconnect of the public from the fact that we're talking lives. We're not talking expedience, you know. The logic about dropping the bombs was that'll shorten the war, right?
Mm-hmm.
It was expedient. And today we aren't in a different, we are in a different time, but the expedient argument for killing people all over the place and for emotionally maiming the people we send out to kill other people, it's totally disconnected. The public and the decision makers, nobody really understands that this is people, right? Mm. And it's not commodities. So the commodity thinking has pervaded public policy, and it has pervaded private lives, because all they think of is, can I really afford 150 television channels? So you know, it's insane.
All right, let's get a response here. Thanks for that, Wolfgang. Appreciate it. Susan, you probably have run across strains of thought like this many times in the work toward the completion of this book.
Yes, I really agree, Wolfgang, and specifically as it regards to the atomic bombings, and even more so about Nagasaki's bombing, the disconnect, often the narrative that our government gives us is skewed, as to some of the circumstances around the military actions we take. And in this case, there was a total disconnect. From the very, very beginning, Nagasaki wasn't really almost part of the story. Hiroshima became the icon, and Hiroshima, even from August 1945, American newspapers got most of the press. But afterwards, American officials were denying the radiation effects. I just want to say out loud to all of your listeners that nothing I wrote in my book in telling these stories is any level of acceptance of the Japanese military governments and the troops' horrific actions. You know, the bombing of Pearl Harbor, the murder and horrific treatment of civilians across Asia as they invaded countries and cities, and the mistreatment and torture and killing of Allied POWs. I just want to say that out loud. But I do think that one thing that Wolfgang points out is that we seem to use all of that horror that, in this case, the Japanese committed, and in contemporary times other nations are committing, as a means to overlook and not examine the consequences of our military actions, which in this case and in many other cases is the mass killings of civilians.
The timeline that you build in the book, too, would seem to indicate that once the news of what had happened in Hiroshima got to the Japanese cabinet, they were seriously thinking for the first time about surrendering. In your opinion, was Nagasaki I don't want to say necessary. It's really hard to come up with the right words there, but, I mean, could we have still gotten the same surrender at about the same time without bombing Nagasaki?
Well, it's a very complex question, and even the best historians, who I admire so much for their very careful analysis of this, don't make definitive decisions, primarily because many of the records of what was going on in the Japanese government at the end were ultimately destroyed. So, but some of the key factors that make that raise doubts about the necessity, the impact of the Nagasaki bombing on Japan's surrender, are that 11 hours before Nagasaki was bombed, the Soviets entered the war. They had moved their troops all the way across the country and invaded Japanese-held Manchuria from three sides, and that was a very key factor for the militarists who were concerned about now having to fight a war on another front.
Much more to talk about with Susan Southard. Her book is Nagasaki, Life After Nuclear War. We'll come back and talk more with her and take your phone calls and emails on the Jefferson Exchange in a minute 10. Final segment on today's Jefferson Exchange. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. Our guest today is the writer Susan Southard. She is the author of a book that just coincides, its release coincides with the 70th anniversary of the American bombing of Nagasaki, Japan. The book is called Nagasaki, Life After Nuclear War. Its central features are profiles of five people who were teenagers at the time of the bombing in Nagasaki and survived and lived to tell their stories many years later. Somewhat reluctantly, it turns out. It's not something people talk about easily in Japan, as you can understand. You can talk about it with us now on the Jefferson Exchange at 800-838-3760 by phone or by email jx@jeffnet.org. So of the five people that you center upon here, were they all injured by the blast?
To some degree, yes, depending on the distance they were from the blast, anywhere from some of the most severe, one boy who was 16, his entire back was burned off. The most severe, people can't imagine how he survived.
That was Taniguchi?
He lay on his stomach for almost 4 years with massive burns on his back that are so grim to watch and to see, and another little 13-year-old boy who happened to be facing the bomb and a half a mile away in the heat of the bomb burned his face very severely, and he was really disfigured for the rest of his life. Others were further out and maybe had glass glass shards that penetrated their body, but all dealt with the radiation exposure to some degree or another.
Now, I'm struck particularly by the story of Do'o Mineko, who was working at a factory. Was it a munitions factory of some kind?
Yes, it was a weapons factory, a Mitsubishi weapons factory in Nagasaki. And again, she was mandated to work there, and her story was so intense. She was in this factory, and it's a massive steel-beamed concrete factory that imploded on top of her and thousands of others, both adults and school children, in the factory. And she was badly injured, physically injured, but miraculously, in my opinion, was able to make her way out of the factory into the annihilated city. Ultimately was found by her father, though her physical injuries eventually healed, she, like tens of thousands of others, got the very horrific radiation symptoms and was declared by her neighborhood doctor that she was about to die, but she survived, and all of her hair that she lost didn't grow back for 10 years. So even after she was physically recovered, she remained in hiding in her house for 10 years after the bombing.
It is through the section in which we learn about Do'o's fate and her work at the factory that you bring us up to date with other events going on in the broader war. You point out that by the spring of 1944, defeat appeared inevitable to Japan's leaders. What was it that prevented Japan's leaders from surrendering a year before they did?
Yes. Well, it was apparent, but the Big Six, the Supreme War Council, who included the Prime Minister and the leaders of the it was pretty much three government leaders and three military leaders were the Big Six who were the ones who made all the decisions. they were split. Half of them wanted to surrender, and the other half wanted to fight to the death. So, and to be sure to preserve the emperor's sovereignty at all costs. And they were really very radical. So they couldn't come to agreement. And even, as you said, the morning of the bomb, of the Nagasaki bombing, 30 minutes before the bombing, the Big Six were already meeting again because the Soviets had just invaded, to try to figure out if they could come to an agreement on surrender terms. Now, you asked me before whether it would have been possible. No one can know that for sure. But what we can know for sure is that the Soviets had just invaded, and that was a huge new factor. That in the years after the bombing, when U.S. officials were justifying having used the bombs, never mentioned that part of the story. They simply say that the bombs, you know, ended the war and saved a million American lives, or some big number like that. And what isn't mentioned is that because the Soviets entered the war, the plans for the Allied invasion of Japan, scheduled for November of that year, would have likely altered to a great degree.
You mean a bit advanced in time, perhaps, to get there before the Soviets?
You mean the atomic bombing?
No, I'm talking about if there would have been a land invasion of Japan. You said that plan would have been altered?
Well, I think because the Soviets were in the war, whether or not that plan to invade three or four months later would have been necessary, or would have been altered or reduced in some way, because Japan really had no resources left. Their troops were depleted. It was only the will of these militarists that was keeping the war going.
What impact did the bombing of Hiroshima have on either the Big Six or the people of Nagasaki? I mean, you talked about how heavily censored news was in wartime Japan. I can't imagine people in Nagasaki knew that much about Hiroshima.
It's a good point. They didn't. The headlines the next day after Hiroshima was bombed was something along the lines of a new-style bomb. Much damage done. You know, in the Japanese newspapers, they had a tendency to minimize the damages that were happening in Japan in order to supposedly keep the morale up, although the morale was completely killed across the country. You know, the civilians in the country were exhausted. They had lost many family members. They had no food, and they could feel the hopelessness of the war, even if they weren't being told about it, the Japanese leaders thought that it was an atomic bomb, and Truman had already announced publicly that it was an atomic bomb, but it wasn't actually confirmed on the ground in Hiroshima until after the Nagasaki bomb was dropped. So they were concerned, the Japanese leaders, about it. It did raise concern. How much it influenced. You know, this was the first time for them to meet after the Hiroshima bombing, was on the morning of the Nagasaki bombing. And I just want to say one other thing, is that in Nagasaki, a few people arrived who had been in Hiroshima either at the time of the bomb or in the days that followed, but really almost no one knew the reality of what had happened in Hiroshima.
So the adults clearly weren't knowing a whole lot about what was going on. You mentioned one of the youngest of the people, Yoshida Katsuji, was 10 years old at the time. He speaks about the flash of light and the force of the blast, and you give some fairly incredible numbers on the kind of explosive force, the amount of heat that was released by this atom bomb. Is there a common thread among the five primary survivors you profile in Nagasaki? What their first knowledge was in the moments after they were aware again of being alive and being in the middle of destruction?
Oh, yes. Well, Do Mineko, who you mentioned before, who was working in the factory, none of them knew it was an atomic bomb, but each of them thought that their building or wherever they had been had been directly hit. Most of them, not everyone, but a lot of people across the city thought that exactly where they were had been directly hit by a conventional bomb, because it was that strong, even miles out from the center of the blast. Each one, it was just beyond even, they couldn't even conceptualize what had happened. If they were so severely injured, they were trying to gain some sense of consciousness, or there was no way to conceptualize, frankly. It was beyond anything we can really imagine. The instantaneous disappearance of their city and the collapse of all of the buildings beyond the immediate reach and beyond the immediate hypocenter of the bomb, and their injuries, and the city became dark because the mushroom cloud that was rising that they were beneath blocked the light of the sun. It was all surreal.
You know, you stated in ways that I can appreciate for the first time, in the sense of thinking that, well, our building got bombed, let's get outside and see if we can help other people, and realizing all the other buildings are gone.
Yes, yes.
And that's a tremendous thing. It's unimaginable, as you've said already.
Uh-huh.
Talk about the part of the city that got hit the worst and what was left there.
Oh, well, the bomb dropped a third of a mile above the ground in the northern valley of Nagasaki. And beneath the point on the ground beneath that is called the hypocenter. And the hypocenter area, nothing was left. And the heat on the ground was the heat that came directly from the bomb dissolved everything, including people and their bodies. And there was nothing left. No people, just kind of rubble and ash.
And so Nagano Etsuko, one of the people you profile, a teenage girl, did find her father, but what she describes then about walking through the streets and finding the people who really couldn't be helped.
Yes, she was on the other side of the mountains from the hypocenter, and had once the bomb had exploded, she heard that her area, her home had, the area where her home was, might have been part of the region that was hit. And she walked 45 minutes back toward the city, and then as she turned the corner and could see on the other side of the mountains and could see this entire valley in front of her, she was just stopped breathless and didn't know what to do. And she searched and searched for some sign of where, some geographical point where she could figure out where her house would have been, and there was nothing. And she was terrified. And the story of what happened to her mother and younger brother and sister is one of the saddest, most personal sadnesses in the book.
What was said in those days, and what do we know now about the dangers to people just entering the blast area after the blast happened?
Yes. Well, the people who entered, of course, the radiation reached out to everyone within a large circle around the hypocenter, miles. But the people poured into the city from first the villages right around this, on the other side of the mountains from the city, and then from other cities to provide relief and rescue efforts. And many people from all over the region were coming in to try to search for family members. So anyone who was going into the hypocenter in the immediate days and maybe up to about 2 weeks risked, they didn't know it, but they were being exposed to the residual radiation. And it's a debated topic because U.S. studies and scientists at the time, at least as after, by mid-September, said all levels were normal for the U.S. occupation troops to enter those cities. But a lot of people came down with the same radiation exposure, and some died. And I want to say that many, many people died later from the horrific effects of radiation on their bodies, even who weren't injured, even who were in the city at the time of the bomb.
The five people you profiled, and there are some additional ones as well that you talked to in the book, I mean, they've all observed a world in which nuclear weapons have not been used again, although we had some good scares along the way. What do they think, though, in terms of anything that mankind might have learned about the use of these weapons or war in general?
Well, I think that they have a lot of courage and stamina in standing up in front of audiences and telling their stories day after day after day. Now they still do it. They're in their 80s because, you know, in large, nuclear weapons, you know, there have been some great treaties over the years that have reduced the number of nuclear weapons, but they still exist and there's still great danger for nuclear weapons use. And they're telling their story against this massive nuclear system that we have in our world to try to impact people's understanding of the personal and the individual and the intimate experience of nuclear war and post-nuclear survival. They hope so much that Nagasaki will be the last atomic bomb city in history.
These are very intimate tales and can't help but be moving. The book is called Nagasaki, Life After Nuclear War. Susan Southard wrote it and joined us today on the Jefferson Exchange. Susan, thank you so much.
Thank you, Jeffrey.
All right, take care. The Nagasaki anniversary, the 70th anniversary, this Sunday, August 9th.